Thank you very much, Melanie. So I'd like to thank the organizers very much for bringing me to one of my favorite places to do physics, and a chance to visit here and give this talk on some of the work I've been doing recently. So what I'm going to talk about today is a couple of snapshots of the landscape. Basically, the idea is I'm going to talk about two specific classes of supersymmetric string vacua. And the goal is to get kind of a mathematical handle on these spaces of vacua in such a way that we can characterize what you're allowed to get in those spaces of vacua and efficiently find models within those sets with certain properties. Can everybody see the bottom of the screen? It's kind of below this, but anyway. So what I'm going to talk about today is based on the magnetized brain part is based on a paper which just came out a couple weeks ago with my student Vijay Kumar. And the second part, which is a little more brief, is based on some work I did several years ago with Mike Douglas and an upcoming paper with an undergraduate at MIT, Vladimir Rosenhaus, and a paper that should come out fairly soon. Let's see if this works. Okay, so again, I'm going to talk about these two classes of vacua, but I want to start out with a little bit of philosophy to kind of explain why I want to think about sets of vacua in this way, sort of the motivation for doing this in the context of the landscape. And then I'll talk about the magnetized brain models and the intersecting brain models. It's a nice small group, so please just stop me if you want to ask a question, if something is unclear or wrong or offensive, or you have something you want to add, just shout right out. I'm happy to discuss anything. Okay, so basically there's this lurking question behind a lot of what people are doing in string theory these days, which has to do with whether string theory really is going to be able to make quantitative predictions for physics at low energies. And of course, this has been something people have debated about for decades. People have long known that there are many solutions to string theory, but the problem has been somewhat sharpened in the last few years, particularly with the discovery of the positive cosmological constant and the realization that there are many discrete vacua of string theory, which seem to have positive cosmological constants, and there are a lot of them. So let me just quickly sort of summarize my take on how to think about this. So I think we'd all agree that it's very unlikely that fundamental quantum gravity effects are going to be something we can measure in precision experiments up to a TeV. I mean, we have a hard enough time seeing the Higgs, finding effects of loops of massive particles and things like that. Physics above a TeV is very hard to see with current experiments. Trying to see physics at the quantum gravity scale seems virtually impossible. But nonetheless, for a long time, people have hoped that somehow when we really understand the foundations of string theory, we can solve the equations, and there will be some systematic way in which string theory picks out certain low energy field theories as more desirable than others. For example, we might want to compute the electron mass, and we might hope that there's really only a few vacua of string theory that look anything like what we see in nature, and that once we nail down the electron mass to two digits, the rest of it will just follow from that particular string vacuum. Unfortunately, this enormous landscape, in particular of vacua, which people have been talking about in recent years with apparent positive cosmological constants, really sort of threatens the notion of predictability below the Planck scale. If there are too many vacua and there are too many things which look like the standard model, we might be able to realize things just like nature, but with very small perturbations on all of the parameters we measure. And if there's 10 to the 200 vacua that look just like the standard model with small variations, and then we measure 200 different digits of coefficients in that model, we won't be able to figure out which one we're in. So the landscape kind of threatens this predictability, and so we'd like to be able to analyze the space of string vacua and answer whether we're really going to be able to make predictions or not. And there are a number of technical issues which make it very difficult to really analyze the set of solutions of string theory. And we all know these, I'll just run them off. You know, we can't really define the theory completely. We don't know how to put all the vacua in one coherent framework. We probably understand only something like a set of measure zero of the true vacua of the theory. There are all kinds of exciting things people are looking at in recent years. G2 compactifications of M theory, non-Kähler manifolds that lots of people, including people here, Katrin and others, have been looking at. Non-geometric compactifications, which many of us have looked at. So there's all kinds of things that we don't really understand. And even in the ones we understand, it's very difficult to compute things. We don't have a good worldsheet description of most of the best understood flux vacui. If we take just type 2 Calabi-Yau compactification with Ramond-Ramond fluxes, although there is this nice pure spinner formalism, and Berkowitz has done some very interesting work, there's not a simple worldsheet description of models with Ramond-Ramond fields, which allows us to really systematically compute things in those backgrounds. So computing is very difficult. And even if we could do all the computations, then we have to ask, what do we do with all these different vacua? And it's been proposed by Douglas and others that we use some kind of probabilistic rules to understand the landscape. But that's very difficult to interpret in a sensible way without understanding better the time dependence and appearance of cosmology in string theory. So we're really in a very challenging situation where we don't really know how to define the theory, we don't know what the set of solutions are, and even if we did, we would have a very hard time making a sensible statement about what that means for predictions.
So, do you need to understand time dependence?
I mean time-dependent backgrounds, as in the time dependence of the cosmological background. Oh. Tunneling from one vacuum to another, things like that. Presumably, you know, that plays an important role in understanding why we're in this vacuum rather than some other, and that's something we don't have a very good understanding yet of time-dependent solutions to string theory. So all this kind of makes things look rather challenging, to say the least. How can we hope for some quantitative predictions to come out of that? So I want to argue that there is actually a way in which we may be able to see that string theory can lead to quantitative predictions. And that involves searching for some kind of systematic constraints arising from string theory. So the general philosophy is the following. Imagine we have some big set of vacua, and you can take whatever your favorite set of vacua is, whatever you know how to calculate best in. It could be 2A, 2B flux vacua, or intersecting brain models, or whatever. And pick some features of the low energy theory. You don't have to pick the whole Lagrangian. You can pick some things like the gauge group, the matter content, maybe some couplings. And you can ask, given this set of vacua, how are the observables you're interested in distributed? And at a very coarse level, there's sort of some extremes of behavior that you may see. One extreme case is that anything goes. You take your set of vacua, you have maybe 2 real parameters that you're trying to compute, you calculate them, you plot them, and you get a space-filling, dense set of points. That I will call situation A, anything goes. Now, of course, in any real class of compactifications, probably anything goes will not go up to an arbitrary high value for your various couplings or masses or whatever. There may be some limits. So more realistically, you may find something which is anything goes within a bounded region. I'll call that situation B, bounded. So here you have a bunch of points, and they all lie in some bounded region. In these situations, it will be very hard to make a prediction, because if the number of vacua is so large that you can be arbitrarily close to any point, then you won't be able to distinguish the standard model from something very close to it. On the other hand, there's another extreme in which there will be some true constraint. That is to say, several parameters that you're interested in may obey some non-trivial constraint conditions so that you can think of one of them or more of them as functions of the others, or that there may be certain combinations of values which are not allowed. This is the other extreme. I'll call this situation C, constrained. If we're in situation A, predictivity will be hard. If we're in situation C, we may be able to make some predictions. So how can we see this? In order to really prove that we have a constraint, you would have to analyze all string theory backgrounds, and that's obviously impossible. But the nice thing is that if there are constraints on the low energy physics, we should see those constraints wherever we look. Yes?
You don't believe that there is some D nothing goes?
It is quite possible, absolutely. Excellent. I don't know whether to call that D or N. Melanie, you have a good point. It is quite possible that when we really understand string theory, we'll realize that none of these solutions are reasonable for some new physics reason that we don't understand yet. Now, from what we understand, the supersymmetric vacua look very plausible. There's a lot of things which protect a lot of the structure of the supersymmetric vacua. So especially when you go to a high amount of supersymmetry, it seems very plausible that these are good solutions, good time-independent solutions of string theory with no cosmological constant. As we break supersymmetry, it becomes less clear. And it is certainly possible, maybe the string theory has no non-supersymmetric solutions. It's a possibility. Maybe it's only got one. In that case, we're in luck.
Are we?
Well, or not, as the case may be. In which case, we hope to be in time. Yes, that is certainly a possibility. And if we really understand string theory, presumably our take on a lot of what I'm saying would change. I'm kind of trying to operate within the framework that we understand right now, where we believe that there's a pretty plausible story in which there are lots of supersymmetric vacua on moduli spaces. It seems pretty plausible that there are many non-supersymmetric vacua off those moduli spaces. I mean, that relates also to the recent results in field theory, ISS and things like that, which suggests that it's a fairly generic feature of a lot of supersymmetric theories that there may be metastable de Sitter vacua in those theories. So it seems plausible to me. I'm just going to go with that piece of the standard lore right now because that's the only thing I really know where to take as a starting point. If we can find any way that most of these solutions break down, that would obviously be a great thing for string predictivity. But let's say that many of these things are there. If there are constraints, then we should see these constraints wherever we look. So if we look at one set of vacua and we see a set of observables, say there's three observables, we see a set of observables which looks like that, that will motivate us to look at some other set of vacua, which a lot where we can compute the same observables. And if we find that disparate sets of vacua give us common constraints, then we can get some suggestion that there may be a global constraint, some constraint which is satisfied by all the vacua. It's not a proof, but it would be a suggestive thing. On the other hand, all we need is one set of vacua which gives us a space-filling set of points, and we know you haven't got a constraint there. Yes?
But how many of these axes do you envision to have to sample?
Well, you can do it for whatever subset you're interested in. And if you find, I mean, the question is, how predictive is string theory? It may be that you have to take the whole standard model and only one of the parameters is predicted, in which case it's going to be very hard to track down. On the other hand, it may be, people talk a lot about whether three generations is or is not favored by string theory. So actually, I'm going to be talking mostly today about discrete parameters, where the picture is very similar, but instead of a continuous axis, we just have a set of points. And in the anything goes scenario, you have lots of vacua on each of the points. And in the constraint scenario, you would only have some of those points occupied and others not. So really, this is for me just a motivation for why one should think about sets of vacua rather than just trying to narrow in on the standard model in string theory. Yes?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand this philosophy. I mean, our low energy world has certain constraints, but I don't see why they should be visible some other strange part of the landscape.
No, not that the constraints.
It seems to be you're requiring these constraints be visible over disparate sets of vacua, right? But it's not guaranteed that's going to happen.
No, what I would say right now, there is no evidence that string theory constrains any class of models in the landscape. Now, I'm not saying that a constraint that we see in our world would be visible in, say, the world of six-dimensional supersymmetric models.
Yeah.
But you could ask, for example, are there any constraints on the world of six-dimensional supersymmetric models? If every six-dimensional supersymmetric model can be realized in string theory, then no, there are no constraints. If every four-dimensional supersymmetric model can be realized in string theory, then there are no constraints coming from string theory. And if we see supersymmetry at, say, the LHC, it will mean that any constraints we see in nature come from the breaking of supersymmetry rather than from imposition of constraints from string theory on supersymmetry.
So the goal here is to hunt for common constraints in disparate sets of vacua.
Correct.
But you don't know if the quarry is out there necessarily.
We do not know if the quarry is out there. My goal actually right now is to find any constraint anywhere in the landscape, because then I would be able to be happy with the notion that string theory constrains something. Right now, we really don't have any proof that string theory constrains anything anywhere in the landscape.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay. So that's kind of the idea. And for that reason, I'm going to be looking at sets of vacua which are a little bit further away from our four-dimensional non-supersymmetric world, because I want to go to places I can calculate. So basically, all this stuff I've been saying motivates the notion that it may be useful to look at classes of vacua to try to characterize them mathematically and understand what range of low-energy field theories they give rise to. And I would say this is sort of complementary to what I would call the standard approach of looking for a realistic physics model in string theory. The general approach is you try to find the standard model by tweaking one parameter after another. Yes?
So what's the relation with the Swampland conjectures?
It is very closely related to the Swampland. Give me 1 minute and I'll come back to that. So let me just spell out the two goals of what I'm doing here. One is to look at some classes of vacua to understand their mathematical structure and what field theories they give rise to looking for constraints. The secondary motivation is that if we have a good mathematical characterization of a class of vacua, we can also find algorithms for constructing sets of models with specific physical properties that we want. So this is also helpful from the model building point of view. So part of the idea of what I want to do is find ways of taking classes of vacua where you can then hand an algorithm to model builders who can say, okay, I want this, this, and this, and they can plug it in and get something out rather than trying things at random. To relate it to the swampland problem, really the question being asked is, what range of effective field theories arise in a loud string vacua? So just to kind of spell out slightly more clearly what I was saying and how it ties into the four-dimensional non-supersymmetric world, if we were able to convince ourselves that anything goes from the point of view of string theory leading to almost any effective field theory in four dimensions without supersymmetry, that would mean that virtually any variation on the standard model could be realized in string theory. We could change all these parameters, and it might be difficult to make concrete predictions until we can do experiments up to something like the Planck scale. To make progress, if that's the situation, is going to require a much better understanding of string theory. We need to understand cosmology. Now, by the way, I'm talking mostly about particle physics here. Liam's going to talk tomorrow about cosmology. And it may be that constraints are easier to find in the cosmological part of the string theory landscape. There certainly is some indication that there are vast swaths of the string theory landscape where you can't realize lots of e-foldings of inflation and things. But I'll leave cosmology to Liam for tomorrow. On the other hand, if we can find that there are any low energy constraints anywhere in the landscape, it will give us confidence that in our four-dimensional non-supersymmetric world, perhaps not all low energy field theories are allowed, and there may actually be some number of parameters in the standard model or in physics beyond the standard model which could be predicted. Okay, so again, this is all just kind of a prelude to explaining why I'm interested in taking these classes of vacua and really getting a clean mathematical description of them. But let me see if there's any other questions here. I'm going to focus on theories with supersymmetry. Basically, the idea is we have much better handle on theories with supersymmetry, so I can actually compute things there. And I said this a minute ago, if in nature supersymmetry is realized at an intermediate energy scale, then if there are no constraints from string theory on the supersymmetric theory, then all the low energy constraints that we see in our models, in the model we see in nature, should come from the supersymmetric field theory and the Suzy breaking mechanism and not from string theory. On the other hand, if there are constraints from string theory on the Suzy theory, there may be some signature of that on the broken Suzy theory we see in nature. If Suzy breaking is at the Planck scale, life is tough for all of us. It's going to be very hard to use string theory to make clean predictions or statements about what's happening in four dimensions if Suzy is broken at the Planck scale, because we have such a hard time saying anything clear and mathematically correct about four-dimensional vacua with Suzy breaking at the Planck scale. Okay, so I'm going to look for models of supersymmetric field theory plus gravity in four and higher dimensions. I'm going to try to mathematically characterize sets of models and also see whether we can take that mathematical characterization and use it to construct models with certain desired features. I'm going to focus on discrete observables, the gauge group and the matter content. By the matter content, I mean the representations of the matter in terms of the gauge group and the number of generations. Not going to worry about the fact that I'm not going to stabilize moduli. Not going to worry about cosmology. That's for tomorrow. And again, this is sort of the motivating question which is pushing me towards asking these questions. Okay, so that's the sort of philosophical prelude. Any questions on that?
Isn't it possible that any constraint you might find is just sort of going to be somebody will come along later and figure out a way around and it's sort of no-go?
It's possible, but if you find a constraint in one corner of the landscape and then you find exactly the same constraint in some totally different corner, which really a priori has nothing to do with the first corner, and then you find the same constraint in a third corner, sure, maybe you've only sampled a set of measure zero, but if there is a constraint, you will find it that way. It may not be a correct constraint, but you will eventually recognize it. If, on the other hand, there are no constraints, you will very rapidly see that. So one way to see this is it's a way of pretty rapidly ruling out constraints, because it's much harder to find those constraints than it is to not find them.
Well, it's a way of ruling out global constraints. Would you be ultimately unsatisfied with constraints that are restricted to separate corners?
I think from our current understanding of string theory, it would be hard to take such a local constraint and make any claim of predictability. If we could realize any variation on the standard model with any value of the masses, the couplings, somewhere in the string landscape, you would have a pretty hard time convincing me that we were really able to predict anything without some much sounder understanding of the cosmology, the distribution on the landscape.
Absolutely. We wouldn't be predicting anything, but we could at least rule out, for example, intersecting grain models of a certain class or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how...
Flex of magnification, something like that.
If you told me that every single possible variation on physics below 10 to the 10th GeV was contained in string theory somewhere, and that all we were doing is figuring out which corner we lived in. Until you get to a point where you can actually make some prediction based on that, I'm not sure that's useful information. So I'm kind of after bigger game. I really want a constraint. I want a global constraint. Okay, so anyway, I'm not going to find one. I just want to motivate. I think the bigger worry is that we do a bunch of analysis like this, and pretty much every time we look, every piece of data we have so far, I would say, is consistent with the notion that everything is pretty much uniformly and randomly distributed in the landscape. So I'm just looking for deviations from uniform random distributions. Okay, so let me talk about something concrete. So this is some work that my student Vijay Kumar and I did on magnetized brain models. A lot of credit for this to Vijay. I've been really distracted by lots of non-research things over the last year, and Vijay has been did a great job pushing this forward at lots of times, so he gets a lot of credit for this. What we wanted to do is to look at a class of so-called magnetized brain models on K3, which are sort of T-duals of intersecting brain models. The notion was we wanted to, so Mike Douglas and I had done some work on intersecting brain models, and if you want to generalize those to Calabi-Yau's, although we heard some very nice, about some very nice work yesterday in which you can really think about these intersecting brain models in terms of some nice mathematics. One simple way to think about generalizations to intersecting brain models to general Calabi-Yau's is by taking the T-dual, so you're in magnetized brain models where now you're in the language of bundles and you might have some simpler mathematical characterization. So we wanted to do this. We figured we'd start with K3. And K3 even has more mathematical subtlety than I ever give it credit for. So
when you're saying taking T-dual on Calabi-Yau, you mean mirror symmetry?
I mean most of the intersecting brain models that have been carried out are actually on toroidal orbifold, toroidal orientifold orbifolds. So Calabi-Yau's. But T-duality, in the general context, I mean mirror symmetry. Whatever. I want to think about magnetized brain models. I'll tell you what they are in a minute. And I'll just tell you, the result, I think, is a very nice and clean mathematical characterization of a certain class of vacua, which can be thought of as a set of six-dimensional n equals 1 supersymmetric models with a rank 16 gauge group. So let me just tell you about what magnetic brain models are. So the setup is we start with type 1 or heterotic with the spin 32 mod Z2 gauge group on K3. And so configurations are described by some kind of bundle on the brains living here. I'm going to think of it mostly from the type 1 point of view, where we have an O9 plane. To cancel the O9 charge, we have 16 D9 brains and their orientifold images. And because K3 has a non-trivial Pontryagin class, there's an extra contribution to the 5-brain charge. So these D9 brains have to carry 5-brain charge, which we can arrange by turning on fluxes. So again, this is kind of a T-dual of an intersecting brain model. So here's the structure of fluxes I want to look at. I want to look at a diagonal flux, so basically a set of abelian fluxes on the different D9 brains. So we can kind of think of this as all the D9 brains are on top of each other, of course, because they're space filling. But if we sort of conceptually separate them out, we can think of them as stacks of brains where N1 brains have flux F1, N2 brains have flux F2. I've just separated out the ones with different fluxes. Each one with a given flux has an orientifold image with minus that flux. And classes of models like this were considered many years ago by Green, Schwartz, and West, more recently by Honecker. They're a nice class of rank, they give you gauge groups of rank 16, very nice simple class of supersymmetric models in type 1 string theory on K3. So that's the general setup. So let me just tell you some of the constraints. So we have these fluxes. So basically, again, we're going to do it in terms of stacks. So we've got N1, N2 groups of brains with certain fluxes on each one. Because we're living on K3, those fluxes are two cohomology classes and take values in the lattice gamma 319, which characterizes the two cohomology of K3, the integral two cohomology of K3. These are integrally quantized, and they live in this lattice, which has a natural inner product coming from the intersection form. And the lattice is just three copies of the indefinite signature 1, 1 lattice coming from the matrix U as an inner product, 0, 1, 1, 0, and two copies of E8 multiplied by minus 1. So it's a signature 3-19 lattice, 3 positive 9-19 directions. And the Fs that we've got that live in this lattice generate some even integral sublattice, lambda, which lives in this thing. Okay? Any questions about that? What's that? These are even because it turns out, actually, well, if you take this lattice, it's easy to see that this is an even lattice. E8 is the smallest even unimodular lattice. These guys are obviously even and unimodular. So this is a nice even unimodular lattice. And you need that, actually, for modular invariance of the string theory from one point of view. Okay, so there's a couple of constraints on the Fs. One is that the total five-brain charge, as measured by integral of F wedge F, has to match the contribution from the Pontryagin class, which is minus a half integral of P1. And if you just put in all your constant factors correctly, what that tells you is that if you sum over the stacks, the sum over A of the number of brains in the eighth stack times FA squared, using the inner product on this lattice, has got to be minus 24. Because the Pontryagin class is 48, so you get a minus 24, and this is just the normalization there. So we have these integral cohomology classes, and the trace, if you will, of F squared, which we just multiplied NA by the FAFA, gives us minus 24. So that's the tadpole constraint. And the other constraint is that we want to have a set of fluxes which are compatible with supersymmetry. That is, the way I'm going to think about this is we're going to select a set of fluxes, and then we're going to ask, is there a complex structure and Kähler structure J which is compatible with these fluxes in a supersymmetric way? And the conditions for that are that F dotted into omega, omega bar, and J have to all vanish. And as long as the lambda, the lattice spanned by the Fs, is a negative definite lattice, it lives in the negative part of this space, and there's always a perpendicular positive definite three-plane which spans omega and J. So for any negative definite lattice lambda, there's always going to be a supersymmetric configuration if we choose the right omega and J. Okay, so I'm trying to find constraints on the Fs which allow us to have a good solution. And the only constraints we've got so far are that the matrix, lattice lambda has to be negative definite, and we have this tadpole constraint. So, in fact, I claim that from the point of view of the Fs, these are the only constraints here for a supersymmetric vacuum. If we define the matrix of inner products, just one second, matrix of inner products MAB, which is FA dot FB, then the sum over A of NA MAA is minus 24, and MAB has to be negative semi-definite, which is the same as the condition that lambda is negative definite, because you can have linear relations between the fluxes. Yes, question.
So if you pick an arbitrary FA, do these supersymmetric constraints stabilize K3 moduli?
Not all of them. So there will be some of them in general. I mean, basically you'll have these perpendicularity conditions. So if you don't choose any Fs, then this positive definite three-plane is a point in the Grassmannian of omegas and Js characterizing a K3. As you put in more and more Fs, you put more and more constraints on the omegas and Js, but nowhere here are you going to completely constrain them. So the assertion I'm making is that for any set of Fs which give you a negative semi-definite matrix M and satisfy the tadpole constraint, there's going to be some moduli space of positive definite three planes perpendicular to all the Fs. And I'm not worrying right now about how big that moduli space is. I'm just worried about what the flux combinations are. So basically, I'm going to identify the discrete data of the low energy theory in terms of the gauge group and the matter content. And then for each of those, there will be some moduli space of that particular class of solutions. Dimension of that is related to the number of matter fields. Okay. Other questions about the model so far?
I mean, there's going to be places in the K3 moduli space if there are no solutions.
But I'm not going around in K3 moduli space and asking what bundles I'm allowed to have there. Instead, I'm choosing the bundle first, which is the thing I need to characterize the six-dimensional data I'm interested in. And for every set of that data, I'm saying there exists a compatible moduli space of complex structure and Kähler structure. So it is certainly the case that there are places in K3, in fact, in a generic place in K3 moduli space, there are no integral cohomology classes perpendicular to the complex structure in J. But that's not the question I'm asking. Instead, I'm saying, what kinds of low energy theories can I get? They're characterized by the intersection matrix FA.FB on the Fs. So I'm going to actually think about this as the parameterizing data of the model. And for each of those that will be allowed, there will be some moduli space. So I'm turning it around from the usual way of doing it. Other questions? Good. So again, just to emphasize this, we're thinking now of the parameters of the model as the NAs and the MAB. And so basically, I can think of this as just discrete data. I can say, okay, I can choose any Ns and any matrix MAB, which is negative semi-definite, and that will give rise to some gauge group and matter content in six dimensions. So the claim is that actually if I choose my Fs, then there's some moduli space of solutions for those Fs. I claim that the gauge group and the matter content is uniquely determined by this combinatorial data. So the gauge group, it's clear. If we go back to the structure of the Fs, the gauge group is given by the commutant of this thing here. So basically you get a UN1 commuting with that, a UN2 commuting with that. So you get a UNA for each of the NAs, and then you get an SO32 minus twice the sum of the Ns taken away from the original SO32. I should mention that because the fluxes have to be at least minus 2 and you have a tadpole condition of 24, you can have at most ranked, you can have at most 12 tied up in this, so you also have to always have at least an SO8, which you can see from lots of other points of view. A couple of technical points. Some of these U1s may be anomalous and become massive. Another interesting technical point is that there are situations where this gauge group is not complete. There are enhancements coming from a coincidence of a small instanton described by F squared equals minus 2, with a shrinking cycle. So when you have this combination of a shrinking cycle where the Kähler class integrated over the cycle vanishes and the instanton is wrapped on that cycle, you can get enhanced gauge groups. And Aspinwall and Morrison and Introligator have looked at analogous situations in non-abelian gauge theories. This one is a little different than that, and I think it's not yet fully understood, but there's a potential for some modification there. The matter content of the theory, that is how many matter fields you have in each of the different representations of the gauge group, is easy to compute from the index theorem, and again, only depends on the NAs and these products of the FAs and FBs. Basically, if you have one brain with a given flux and another brain with a flux F prime, then you're just looking at the N plus minus N minus, the number of right move, the number of right-handed minus left-handed fermions living in that thing, which is given by an index theorem. You do the calculation, and in each of the different representations, you get some number of hypermultiplets. So these are sets of matter fields. And you can just compute these, and you see that everything is written as a constant plus some linear combination of Fs squared. And of course, each of these terms can be written in terms of the MABs. This is MAA plus MBB minus 2MAB. For instance. So again, the thing I want to emphasize here is that all the data we're interested in about the low energy theory, the gauge group and the matter content, completely depends on the N's and the M's. So for example, you might want to make sure that your low energy theory is non-anomalous, and you can check that with these combinations of matter fields, you get cancellation of the gravitational and field strength anomalies. So for instance, if you calculate NH minus NV plus 29 NT, that comes out to the famous 273 for these supersymmetric six-dimensional models. And things like this were calculated for some subset of these and analogous models in these papers. Okay, so the point of this transparency is that the physics we're interested in six dimensions is parameterized by the N's and M's, so that's all the data we need. Yes, question.
So what about the gauge couplings? Do they depend on K3 moduli?
The gauge couplings may depend on more things. I'm not looking yet at the gauge couplings or at masses or anything like that. I mean, these are all massless fields here, but yeah, I'm not looking at the couplings at this stage. I'm really just looking at the matter content and the gauge group. And you could do more careful analysis to try to understand what happens to those things. So to summarize where we are so far, for this class of models, N and M parameterize the six-dimensional physics, and the only constraints we know of on those things so far are that this trace condition, which comes from the tadpole, and the supersymmetry condition, which says that MAB is a negative semi-definite matrix. Okay, so now the question we want to ask is, up to these constraints, which possible N's and M's can we realize in string theory? Right, can we realize absolutely anything, or are there some constraints on what N's and M's we can realize? So what I'm trying to do here is to break up, I'm sort of going back to the philosophy at the beginning, I'm trying to break up our understanding of this class of models into a set of constraints, which have to do here with these constraints here and how you get six-dimensional physics from the N's and M's, and the freedom of the model having to do with what range of N's and M's will be possible, or whether there are more constraints at this in terms of this parameterization. So any questions about that? Okay, so the remarkable, at least to me, result is that any N and M which are compatible with the tadpole and Suzy conditions can be realized in string theory. And furthermore, if you have two models with the same N and M, then to zeroth order, they're equivalent up to duality. So any the realization of any given N and M is essentially unique up to duality symmetries. And the only caveat there is that occasionally there's a discrete redundancy coming from multiple models which have a slight topological distinction, which I'll describe in a moment, which is a sort of a generalization of some Dion invariants found recently by Banerjee and Sen. And I'll describe this in a minute. I just want to tell you the answer first before I get into describing where the answer comes from. The point is that with this parameterization, all the constraints on six-dimensional physics come from the tadpole and Suzy constraint and the way in which we write the gauge group and the matter content in terms of the N's and M's. And up to those constraints, we can get any of these parameters that we want from string theory. Okay, and the key to understanding this has to do with some results of a mathematician, Nikulin, on lattice embeddings, which I will now tell you a little bit about. So are there any questions about the statement of what we end up with before I get into a little bit of lattice theory? Yes?
You're still allowed to vary all the other parameters that you're not looking at, right? In this?
Well, okay, so the question I'm asking is, what range of gauge groups and matter content can we realize in six-dimensional n equals one field theories through this kind of construction? And I've shown you that the gauge groups and matter content we can get are parameterized by this N and M, which have those constraints. And now I'm claiming that any N and M satisfying those constraints can be realized in string theory. Now, when you say I'm varying other parameters, you mean like the complex structure moduli? Sure. So those would be places in the moduli space of theory with theories with this particular gauge group and matter content. Right? So in any one of these theories, there's a supersymmetric theory with a certain gauge group and matter content. There are massless scalars which correspond to deforming the theory and moving around on the moduli space. And the numbers of those scalars have to do with the numbers of hypermultiplets, and they tell you how high dimensional the moduli space is. So each one of these theories I'm talking about is a full moduli space of theories.
You're saying you get the whole moduli space in each case from string theory?
I haven't said that, but that statement I believe is correct in these situations. The statement I'm making is that you get all the different moduli spaces. Because string theory sees all the scalar fields, unless there's some issue with the completeness of the space or something, or weird string physics cutting you off from some other end of the moduli space, you will get the whole moduli space if you have a piece of it. I think that the strong statement I'm making here is that any of those moduli spaces which you might have imagined was available based on this parameterization can in fact be realized in string theory. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about lattice embedding theorems, because I didn't know much about this and it's kind of a neat story, and it really is at the core of why this kind of existence in so let me just repeat. The point is that for a given class of models, there's really an existence and uniqueness theorem for a string realization of those models. So again, this comes from certain existence and uniqueness theorems for lattice embeddings. So let me tell you a little bit about lattice embeddings so that we're clear about where that comes from. So to show you the flavor of this kind of result, I'm going to do a simple example with a one-dimensional embedding into a higher dimensional lattice. So the idea is basically to ask about embeddings of a vector into a lattice. So imagine somebody hands you a lattice, and it's got an inner product. So any two elements, x and y, you can dot them together and you get an integer. And then let's say somebody says, okay, I want to find a vector with norm nu, meaning they want a vector with x squared equals nu, where nu is some integer. there's two questions you can ask. One is, does there exist such an integer? Sorry, does there exist such a vector x so that x squared equals nu? And then there's a uniqueness question. If you find such an x, is it unique up to automorphisms of the lattice? Or are there many different vectors with the same norm which are not related by some symmetry of the lattice? All right, so any questions about that? Very simple math question. I'll give you a lattice. Can you find a vector with any norm you want? And if you can find it, is it unique? Let's do a simple case. Let's do a Cartesian lattice with an inner product, which is a delta Kronecker delta AB. So the norm nu is equal to a squared plus b squared, where a and b are the coordinates. So for instance, 5 is equal to 2 squared plus 1 squared. If somebody gives you nu equals 5, you say, yes, there is a vector. How about existence and uniqueness for a general nu? The existence of a vector with a given norm is not guaranteed. If somebody gives you 7, there is no vector with norm 7 in this lattice. Existence is also not guaranteed. 65 can be written as 8 squared plus 1 squared. It can also be written as 7 squared plus 4 squared. Those are not related by a symmetry of the lattice. So there are multiple different vectors with the same norm. So we are not guaranteed either existence nor uniqueness for this kind of lattice. If we make our lattice a little nicer, we give it a little extra structure. If we make it in particular even and unimodular, so by the way, this net lattice here is unimodular, meaning it's got a unit cell of volume 1. Also, you can say it as the dual lattice is equal to the lattice. This is a unimodular lattice, but it's odd because there are things with odd norms. This is if we take an even unimodular lattice, if we take one of a definite signature, the smallest one we can get is the root lattice of E8. And you're all familiar with the way of writing the root lattice of E8. Another way to present E8 is as the lattice spanned by all sequences of X1 through X8, where each of the X's is either an integer or a half integer. So either every one of them is an integer or every one of them is a half integer. And the sum of them is equal to an even integer. That's another presentation of the E8 root lattice, which is a little more symmetric. It's pretty easy to show from this presentation that you are guaranteed the existence of a vector of norm nu for any even integer nu. So somebody hands you an even integer, you can find a vector with that norm. But uniqueness is not guaranteed. For instance, for nu equals 14, there are two x's which are not related by a lattice automorphism which have that same norm, just like happened over here.
Is 14 the first example?
It is, in fact. Well, there's actually an example at 8. But the one at 8 is kind of trivial. It involves a non-primitive vector. I haven't mentioned primitive yet, but obviously if you have a vector of norm 2, right, then if I take twice that vector, 2x squared, it's equal to 8. So there are two different kinds of lattice vector in E8 of norm 8. Oh, thanks. One of them is twice a vector of norm 2, and one of them is a primitive vector. So for nu equals 8, there are two vectors, but one of them is a multiple of a primitive vector. The first place where you have a non-primitive redundancy, where you have two primitive vectors of the same norm is at 14, I believe. And there's an online list. If you look at the online encyclopedia of integer sequences, you will see a little program by Noam Elkies that calculates these up to very high order. I actually bothered Noam about this, and he referred me to this online encyclopedia of integer sequences, and I looked at it and got some information. And then a month later, I looked back, and it was a much better thing that he had written, described a much larger set of numbers. Anyway. Okay. What we want to do, though, now is we want to make our lattice even nicer. We want to make our lattice even nicer by making it indefinite signature. If we make it indefinite signature, and we put in at least two directions of each sign, which means that the rank is at least 4 plus the signature, for example, this means that it's got at least two factors of u in it. There's a nice categorization of all indefinite signature lattices, and they're basically sums of u's in E8s. If you have at least two u's, that is, if you've got at least two in each direction, then there's a very beautiful theorem by Wall, which can be proven using totally elementary means. You just rotate things around in a very simple way for u plus u and show that existence is guaranteed. Well, existence is guaranteed is easy. Take 2x. If you've got u plus u, 1x, 0, 0 has a norm of 2x. But you're guaranteed uniqueness up to lattice automorphism. That is to say, if you have there's a unique primitive vector which squares to any norm nu up to lattice isomorphism. So there's a unique primitive vector up to automorphism of the lattice. It's a little cryptic because I had to cram it in the bottom of this little thing here. But the point is you have an existence and uniqueness theorem for the embedding of a vector with any norm into a lattice of sufficiently indefinite signature. So this is kind of neat. It means that, it's kind of bizarre actually, it means that no matter how big your number is, if you take an indefinite signature lattice, there's a unique up to automorphism vector with any norm you want that's primitive.
Yeah, is it because this lattice somehow has a lot of automorphisms?
It is because this lattice has a lot of automorphisms. That's exactly right. Yeah, so the group of automorphisms of E8 is a finite group, and the group of automorphisms of these indefinite signature things are tremendously complicated and infinite, I believe. And I don't think anybody totally understands them for very large lattices. I think for U plus U, it's probably understood. Yes?
Is the indefinite signature necessary to realize this trick, or is this just an easy way of doing it?
I don't know any lattice which does not have indefinite signature which realizes this.
Circumstantial evidence, but no proof.
I'm sure that an expert on lattices could tell you, that, but I'm not. If you look at Conway and Sloan's book, it might tell you. But I don't know the answer to that. I mean, you know, the problem is that there's not a huge number of, let's say you want unimodular, there's not so many different unimodular lattices for low dimensions, right? You have even unimodular lattices, the first one's E8, then up at dimension 16, you've got E8 plus E8 and lambda 16, those things are all have non-unique vectors. Anyway, the indefinite signature just works magic, and I think it is related, as Andy said, to this enormous automorphism group. Okay, so this is a little prototype for Nikulin's theorem, which I'll now just quote to you. Nikulin's theorem is basically the same thing on steroids. It's doing this, but now you're mapping not just a vector, but an arbitrary even lattice of signature T plus T minus into a bigger unimodular lattice, L. And the statement Nikulin makes is that if you're embedding any lattice into a bigger lattice of indefinite signature, then there exists a unique primitive embedding of the smaller lattice M into the bigger lattice lambda, given a set of conditions. And among other things, the conditions say, well, you have to have more positive and more negative directions in the bigger lattice than in the smaller one. And then there are some slightly cryptic conditions having to do, I'll just quickly say this because I don't want to get into the details. There's a nice finite group defined by taking the dual of a lattice M star, dividing it by M. If it's unimodular, then of course that's a trivial group, but in general it's not, if this is not, M is not unimodular. And then you can take the components of AM, which have elements of order P to the K, that's a little group of things of order P, or P to the K, and the number of generators of that plays a role in this theorem. A primitive embedding, by the way, is one where the embedded linear space containing that image of the lattice contains only the points in the image of the lattice and not extra ones. It's just the generalization of this. Like this, if you were embedding a lattice generated by this, it would not be primitive because there's some extra vector in there that wasn't in that. So I don't want to get into the details of the theorem. There's some technical details having to do with this prime stuff, which get a little complicated. Let me just point out one simple thing. The number of generators of this group has to be less than or equal to the dimension of the lattice M, because this quotient group is just a little finite group of lattice points in a unit cell of M star slash M. Got to be less than or equal to T plus minus T minus. So if we just replace L everywhere with T plus plus T minus, you see that this condition becomes just that the dimension of the embedding space L is greater than or equal to 2 plus twice the dimension of the embedded space. And if we know that this is gamma 319, that's 22, so it means that that's got to be greater than or equal to 2 plus twice 10. And it means that this theorem is absolutely fine any time we have a definite signature lattice of dimension less than 10. So this is kind of remarkable. It says you give me any even lattice of dimension less than 10, and I can embed it in gamma 319 in a unique way up to lattice automorphism.
Is this sufficient condition or necessary?
This is a sufficient condition. There are other situations where this can happen. But if these things are true, then there exists a unique primitive embedding. And we had to play with this a little bit because, as I mentioned, the most fluxes we can turn on is 12, right? So that's almost covered by the theorem, but not quite. So we had to look at a bunch of special cases where you have 11 or 12, and then you have to get into the P stuff, and I don't want to bore you with that. But let me just tell you the upshot. We take this theorem, and we fiddle around with some special cases, and what we find is that for absolutely every N and M satisfying the tadpole plus Suzy constraints, that matrix MAB gives you a lattice which embeds into gamma 319. And then so that means that in each of these cases, we can find an embedding. Therefore, there exists some Fs. Therefore, there exists a complex structure in Kähler modulus. So in fact, anything goes in the sense that we can choose any N and M and MAB satisfying tadpole and Suzy. And in every case except one, we can choose that lattice to be embedded in a primitive fashion. There's one case, which is where we have 12 minus 2s on the diagonal, where you can't realize a primitive embedding. And I'll refer to that in just one second. But you can still find an embedding. I mentioned a redundancy. There's a redundancy having to do with the fact that if you choose some M associated with some lattice, there's a unique primitive embedding. But if there's an overlattice of M, oh shoot, the overlattice is not. So this one here is supposed to have little extra dots here in the middle of the rectangles, which represent an overlattice. If you have an embedding so that there are extra points in the linear space spanned by that in the image, that corresponds to an embedding of an overlattice. And so you can categorize those overlattices. They give you some discrete redundancy. And this is sort of a nice generalization to higher dimension of these Banerjee and Sen-Dion invariants, which is the two-dimensional version that I mentioned a little while ago. I won't get into that. Bottom line is, the fact that we can find an embedding for any one of these things completely in a clean way separates the constraints on the low energy physics, which are the tadpole condition, the Suzy condition, and the way in which the 6D physics depends on N and M, from the freedom, which is we can choose any N and M. Stop there for a moment for questions.
So are you going to say anything more about this degeneracy? I'm just curious whether it's typically of the same size, whether there's a large range.
No, I would say, you know, just anecdote, you know, from the numbers we looked at, maybe 1 out of 10 of these has a redundancy of 2 or 3. It's, you know, you look at, you know, some set of 100 one of these things, and there's maybe 5 or 6 ones with overlattice possibilities. And we have sort of a systematic way of analyzing that. You can put it all on a computer and compute it if you want. I wasn't going to get too far into it, but go ahead.
And also in Nicklewin's theorem.
Yes.
I mean, in the simple versions you described, there was this up to automorphisms.
Yes. His also has
something like that in here as well.
Primitive embedding. This unique here merely means unique up to automorphism. Sorry, I just elided that.
I mean, what the logical status of those automorphisms is in string theory? I mean, is that a kind of a gauge symmetry?
Those are duality symmetries. Those are symmetry. I mean, here's one way to think of it. This is just a K3 compactification. So there's a theorem in mathematics, which I think is called the global Torelli theorem, which says that any automorphism of gamma 319 can be carried to a diffeomorphism of K3 disconnected from the identity.
I see.
So it's really just moving you around on the moduli space of K3s. Basically, it's saying if you have one and I have another one up to an automorphism, your and mine are just different by two different labelings of the cycles on the K3. It all has to do with your choice of cycles on the K3 for some canonical coordinatization, but they're really equivalent. So in this case, I think it's a duality symmetry, which is very clearly understood. It's just a relabeling of the cycles on the K3. Same thing as for the torus. Okay, I'm kind of running low on time, so I'm going to whip through a bit. Let me just give you very quickly an example, just to give you a little better feeling of this. So a famous sublattice of gamma 319 is the Kummer lattice. If you take the orbifold construction of K3, and you then there's two tori multiplied by each other, there are 16 singular points. If you blow up all those 16 singular points, you have 16 curves EI, and there's a sublattice of gamma 319, which includes, it's a linear space containing all those EIs, and also half sums of the EIs, where you sum the EIs over all possible affine hyperplanes in a four-dimensional Boolean cube. And so with that representation, it's actually quite easy to see a primitive embedding of the 11-dimensional matrix with all minus 2s on the diagonals. You basically choose 11 of the E's, and if you choose 11 of the E's, you can choose them in such a way, as I've done here, that the set of points chosen does not include any hyperplanes in the four-dimensional cube. But if you look carefully at this, you'll see that any additional point would include a hyperplane. If I pick this point here, I've got this plane here. If I pick this point here, I've got this square and this square. If I choose this one here, then actually I've got this point and these three and these three and this opposite one, which is another affine hyperplane. So we can embed 2 to minus 2 to the 11. We cannot embed 2 to the 12th in a primitive fashion, but we can embed it by just choosing another point there. That's an embedding, but it contains an overlattice. So that's an example of one of these embeddings, just to give you a concrete picture of that. Okay. I mentioned at the beginning that one of the things I want to be able to do is take a mathematical characterization of a class of models and say, pick out all the models with some nice feature, like with SU3 cross SU2 as a subset of the gauge group. And this is totally straightforward. Basically, all you need to do is ask for a piece of the lattice where N1 equals 3, N2 equals 2. That gives you a little piece of the lattice. You pick those things, and you can just scan over all the possible values. You don't need information about the rest of the model. I will contrast this with the IBM toroidal orientifold models, which I will blast through in the next 3 minutes, where this is very different, and it takes a huge amount of work to find all the models satisfying this condition. I'm assuming I should aim at, what time should I aim at stopping?
You're fine, so just roll whatever you need.
Okay. We'll just didn't say that. I'll try to move fairly rapidly, but I'll aim in another 5 to 10 minutes.
That's fine.
Questions about that?
I have a simple question. So is this n equal to 1 in 6D?
This is n equals to 1 in 6D. That's correct. Mm-hmm. So we could compactify on another T2, and we would get n equals 2 in 4D. Okay, so we can, if we want, pick out all the models with some particular structure. Just a couple comments. So I mentioned that one of the constraints has to do with the way in which the number of hypermultiplets and the gauge group depends upon our choice of N and M. There are a bunch of choices here where it's pretty easy to show that this construction, in fact, gives you all the possible sets of hypermultiplets that are allowed by anomaly cancellation. So there, you can really say that in that class of rank 16 models with some statements about what the gauge group and allowed representations are, if you solve the anomaly conditions, every single model you get is realized in some way in string theory. And more than that, it's realized in string theory in a unique way. So if that was true everywhere, it would be pretty interesting. I would say that whatever model we have in low energy physics is realized in string theory, and it's realized in a unique way. It'd be kind of the ultimate correspondence between string theory and low energy physics. I should mention that these are special points in the moduli space. I've turned on only abelian fluxes. If we turn on non-abelian fluxes, we'll get a lower rank gauge group, and we'll get a more general point on the moduli space. And a lot of the work on these K3 compactifications with bundles has been on the non-abelian bundles, and there's a beautiful story related to a lot of that, like the Aspinwall-Morris and Intelligator enhancement of gauge group by singularities and things like that. And so to really completely analyze things, we need to include this enhancement from small instantons on shrinking cycles, which, again, was done by these guys for the non-abelian case, but it requires, I think, a bit more work in the abelian case. Okay, so that's more or less what I wanted to say about magnetic brain models. So I'm close to what I was supposed to stop. So I'll just give you a quick flash through some of the intersecting brain models, unless there are any further questions on this. Yes?
Would one expect to have much more constraints if you have half of the supercharging?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's not clear, actually, right? I mean, why should you have, there will be many more theories, but there will also be many more string compactifications, right? It's not obvious to me, actually. I mean, it seems more, it's harder to show that you get anything you want with less supersymmetry. It's not obvious that it can't be true, because you have many more ways to compactify string theory. Other questions? Okay, so here's a quick flash through intersecting brain models. So this class of models that is well known and loved, people have been looking at these for years, and they're liked because they're easy to compute things, and there are models where you get, as a subset of, in some piece of the model, you get the standard model gauge group with three generations, but you usually get some additional exotic matter fields, and lots of people have looked at those. And there's been a sort of attempt in recent years to systematically study these. There was some very nice work by Blumenhagen, Gmeiner, Honecker, Lust, and Weigand, where they did a computer search through all these models. They ran a computer for a year, and they found some statistics on these things. After that, Mike Douglas and I did some analysis of this from an analytic point of view and managed to show, for instance, that there's a finite number of models in this set. And more recently, Vladimir Rosenhaus, the undergraduate I mentioned at MIT, and I, and partly due to the perseverance of Vladimir, who wrote some big computer programs to analyze these spaces and give us a better handle on what's going on, we've got a complete analysis of this. Let me just summarize this. Intersecting brain models, you've got three tori, as we have here. You've got brains winding. We're going to take these six brains wound in various ways according to winding numbers m and n. There are four tadpoles. Unlike in the K3 case where there was one tadpole that had to be canceled, here there are four of them. And the cancellation conditions of the tadpole say that the sum of the p, so each brain has associated with it a p, a q, an r, and an s. And the sum of the p's and the sum of the q's and the sum of the r's and the sum of the s's all have to add up to 8. That's just like the condition that the sum of the f squareds had to add up to 24 in the previous thing. And then there are some Suzy conditions which have to be satisfied for each brain for moduli J, K, and L, which have to do with the shape of the tori. The tricky thing about this model is that there are some brains which have negative contributions to the tadpoles. So if all brains contributed positively to all tadpoles, then this would be a simple partition problem. We would have a vector 8, 8, 8, 8. And we would be saying, okay, we have a bunch of vectors which are supposed to sum up and give you this 8, 8, 8, 8. And if they're all positive vectors, then it's obvious that there's a finite number of solutions. It's a simple partition problem. But we're allowed to have vectors with a negative component in this vector space, 3 positive, 1 negative. Thanks a lot. 3 positive, 1 negative. And that makes the problem much more tricky. In fact, for a long time, it was not at all clear whether there were a finite or an infinite number of solutions to these Suzy equations and the tadpole cancellation conditions. So what Blumenhagen et al. Did, oh, shoot, I forgot to put that number in, but it's easy to find. They fixed the moduli, these rational numbers J, K, and L, which can be made into integers. So they had 4 integer moduli, and they scanned over the norm of the integer moduli. For any fixed modulus, you get a positive definiteness condition and a finite number of solutions. The question is, are there an infinite number of different moduli at which you have that finite number of solutions? They scanned up to U is about 12. They found about 100 million models in about a year of computer time. The complexity of their algorithm grew exponentially. They seemed to have found most models because it looked like there was a tail that was going down. And they looked at their data and they said the components of the gauge group and the number of generations are roughly random. So Mike and I managed to find an analytic proof that there are a finite total number of solutions, and we found some analytic bounds on these combinations of the brains with negative tadpoles. And in this work with Vladimir, what we've managed to do is construct all possible combinations of the brains with negative tadpoles that are compatible with supersymmetry. There are 99,479 of them, and anybody who wants can have the file. What's that?
Why is that less than 10 to the 8?
Because their models include these negative contribution brains, A, plus lots of B's and C's, which are the ones with only positive tadpoles. So what we found is the combinations of A brains which undersaturate the tadpole conditions, and to each of those you can add many, many, many combinations of B's and C's. And in fact, the way in which you do that completion will have to do with why what they found is a little different than what we found. So once you know all the A brain combinations, then you can construct all models with some desired features, just like what I was doing for K3. You can pick a gauge group and find every model with a certain gauge group as a subgroup of the total group. We looked at some of these models. We've confirmed that there's a roughly random distribution in the gauge group and number of generations. The interesting thing which we found, however, which I think goes beyond what these guys found, is that a lot of the diversity comes in this tail of the distribution. Let me just tell you a little bit about that.
Just what is it that puts the bounds on the A brain combination? Sorry, I missed.
I wish I had a better theoretical understanding. What we have is a bunch of inequalities where you use, you know, funny little rules like, you know, 1 over x plus you can relate reciprocals of various things to sums of other reciprocals and put bounds on them. And you can use that to show that, I mean, you just play around with inequalities for a while.
But where do they come from, like qualitatively?
They come from the Suzy conditions. So the Suzy conditions say that these ratios have to be positive, but that this ratio, which is the sum of the reciprocals of those guys, has to vanish.
And so that's what leads to those things, which leads to those
A. That leads to those things, which allows you to prove that you can't have A brains satisfy. I mean, it, right now, to be honest, it's a little bit of a mess what we did to prove it. But we found a bunch of inequalities which allow you to prove that there's, first of all, a finite number of solutions, and second of all, allow you to bound them well enough that you can run a little computer program which calculates
these. Those other people ignored that, which is why they found more stuff, basically.
They didn't ignore that. We will find all the models they found. So if we so let's say we wanted to find
lots more.
Well, that's because we've only got a piece of the models with our A-brain combination.
Yeah, so I say you imposed additional.
No, no. Well, we've only in this piece we've only constructed a piece of the models that we're interested in. So if we wanted to construct a full model, like one simple A-brain combination, there's an A-brain combination which has contributions to the tadpole minus 512. Well, that's not a good one. Let's say there's one which has. 4, 4, 4, minus 64. So that would be what I would call an A-brain combination. It's a single A-brain which has contributions minus 64, 4, 4, and 4. The full model will be that plus a bunch of things like 2, 2, these other kinds of brains. So there's actually an exponentially large number of ways of adding B and C brains to this thing to get a full model. What they were looking at was that full range of things where they take the A brains and they add the other stuff.
Okay, and you're just looking at the first.
Right, but what they were doing is they were looking for fixed moduli. And what we found is that almost all the models of interest are way out on the moduli. So they were not in the set that they scanned. And so there's a little contradiction there, which is they seem to find most of the models, and yet we're finding most of the diversity out in the tail of the distribution. So let me just explain that. We looked at, for instance, how many different ways there are of realizing the gauge group SU3 cross SU2 cross a U1, which is not associated with one of these two brain sets, as a subgroup of the gauge group. So again, this is just a piece of the model. I'm saying we're going to say, how many ways are there of getting this as a piece of the model, and you can add anything else you want. And for each of the 10 to the 5th A-brain combinations, we looked at all the ways of adding Bs and Cs to realize this as a subgroup. So we found about 13 million combinations which give you this gauge group as a subgroup of the full gauge group. Now, associated with each one of these 13 million models, there will be anywhere from a dozen to 10,000 complete models with some additional sector of stuff. Because these combinations do not saturate the tadpole conditions, they undersaturate them. So these are basically sectors of the model in which you realize this part of the gauge group in different ways. And for each of those different combinations, there's going to be a certain number of extra sectors that you can add. And in their computation, they included all those different possible extra sectors as different models. That's why their number is so much bigger. But now we looked at the moduli. So of those 13.4 million, we found that for 12.9 million of them, the moduli were fixed by that choice of brains. And a typical modulus was on the order of 1,000. So here's the distribution of the number of models as a function of the modulus. You can't really read it very well, but this is 5,000 there. So the set of models they looked at was up to 12, right? And here we're getting up to 5,000. They found that most of the models they were interested in, most of the models by their counting, were in this little tiny thing. But we're finding this huge distribution of models out here. What is the explanation for that discrepancy? The point is that we get more diverse combinations of this physical or the 3-2-1 combinations when we have a very large negative tadpole from some A. Basically, if you have some A brains which have a big negative tadpole like that, you've got lots of room to throw in all kinds of other different combinations. But at the same time, you can't throw in as many extra brains. So those negative tadpoles are associated with large moduli. So what we find is that there's more diversity in the ways of realizing a particular gauge group out at larger moduli, but there are fewer extra sectors you can throw in. So by their counting of the number of models, almost everything is down here. But by our counting of the number of ways of realizing a subgroup, almost everything is out in the tail. So I'm just sort of encapsulating that in this slogan, the diversity is in the tail. That there, most of the models, if you look at the complete model, including all the hidden sectors, or sectors you're not including in your gauge group of interest, they would be down here. But if you just ask how many different ways are there of realizing some particular structure you might be interested in, the diversity of that way, the ways of realizing that will be way out on the tail, where there's not lots of extra stuff you can throw in, but there's more different ways of doing it. So this explains one thing, which was that people had found, by sort of brute force, various combinations with the standard model gauge group in three generations. they did not identify those in their analysis. For instance, one of them happens at modulus 26. And it looked, from their point of view, as if those were just some very highly anomalous configurations with large moduli. In fact, what we understand now a little better, I think, is that the bulk of the models are indeed at small modulus, but the bulk of the models had very little diversity in terms of how you would realize a 3-2-1 gauge group combination. Most of the diversity of the gauge group embedding is way out in the tail. Yes?
So what do you mean by large and small modulus? Are these large ratios of...
Sorry, I mean, I'm taking the moduli and I'm turning them into integers. So right there, we have J, K, and L are rational numbers. We can always think of those as sort of projectivize them and put them over the integers. So now we can think of that as four different integers, H, J, K, L. Put those in reduced terms.
Or could you go back?
Yeah.
What's that?
Can you define the H, J, K, L?
Oh, the H, J, K, L are just the they're the ratio of the height to the width of the three different tori.
Good. So when you say U equals 1,000, it means that there's an angle of order 1/1,000.
Well, not necessarily. It might mean that you have 999 and 1,000. Right, which has one of the U's is 1,000, one of the U's is 999. It's almost a square torus, but you can't put them, you can't throw out any common factors. Right, there's no common divisors of 999 and 1,000.
Just implies fine tuning of some kind.
Yeah, so you know, really what it means is that you're, the integers involved in this thing are getting much bigger.
And you say, is there a fundamental restriction to restrict to these rational numbers, or is that just something you do for the convenience of enumerating them?
They did it for the convenience of enumerating them. There is no a priori reason that those numbers can't get arbitrarily large. The only reason that they're really bounded is because of the bounds from the tadpole, which restrict the class of possible A-brains. But I mean, these numbers go up to the many thousands.
But I mean, is the restriction to integers fundamental, or could I, are there models with arbitrary
rules? Oh no, it's just the, when you solve the Susie conditions, because the tadpoles are always integer. The tadpoles are given by integer combinations of the winding numbers. The moduli, once you have at least three brains in general, generically you have three linear equations and three unknowns. And if you have three linear equations with integer coefficients and three unknowns, the solutions will be rationals.
The unique solution.
Yeah, once you get enough brains that there's a unique solution, the solution will always be over the rationals. Yeah. Okay, I should wrap up quickly. I'll just mention that we did not find any suppression of three generations. You can look at the number of generations of quarks in these guys, and it runs out. It's order 10, it runs out to about 100. There's no suppression. Let me just conclude.
So how long did your computer run?
For which calculation? For the 3-2-1 for a day or two. Vladimir's computer ran for a day or two.
Wait, you find this 13 million backlog.
That was a couple days.
And then you don't need it?
Well, they were using a very different algorithm. Their algorithm becomes exponentially hard as you go out. Ours is polynomial. Let me just summarize quickly. For the magnetized brain models, Nikulin's theorem gives us a very simple mathematical characterization of the space of models. We have these constraints. For anything satisfying the constraints, we have a lattice embedding, and the models are unique up to dualities and this over-lattice discrete redundancy, and allow us to construct models with properties we want. Intersecting brain models, we've completely analyzed the negative tadpoles. We can construct models we want, and there's this diversity is in the tail. There's various things we could do to go ahead, but I'll stop there because I'm over time. I don't know, not yet. Don't hesitate to.
So I have a question regarding this anything goes unpredictability issue. So we're sort of just looking at sort of a few number of parameters in the sort of the total number of parameters we have in the standard model. So, and I would think that we want to find correlations between the different parameters we have. And so I was just wondering if we require more parameters in the theory, and wouldn't there be, perhaps there might be interesting correlations among the more realistic type of models that we see.
Absolutely. So that would be the long range effort of this sort of program would be to go down to less and less supersymmetry, fewer and fewer dimensions, and to calculate more and more of the features in the low energy Lagrangian. So the reason I think we're not screwed is because I think that we're very far from being able to make any concrete statements about the set of four-dimensional non-supersymmetric vacua, which is where you would try to do the kind of thing you're talking about. And in these higher dimensional theories, in, for instance, six-dimensional supersymmetric theories, you actually don't have that many free parameters. Most of those free parameters have to do with the moduli space. And if you can realize a moduli space, you're actually realizing all the theories in that set. As you break more supersymmetry, go down to lower dimensions, then on the one hand, yes, there are more parameters to fit, but on the other hand, there are more parameters to put in when you talk about the string compactification. And the question is whether the number of parameters in the model that you're trying to fit becomes greater than the number of parameters you're putting into your string compactification.
Right, so even in this particular case, so yes. For each solution, yeah, each primitive embedding you have, there is, you could still vary some complex parameters.
Right, that's the moduli space.
Right.
So for each one of these theories, there's a moduli space associated with what those scalars can do.
Right.
And that would call that one piece of the theory space.
Right, but the moduli space would probably have different dimensions for different types of embedding you have.
Absolutely. And so that's what we've calculated when we calculate the number of hypermultiplets in these various things. So we're seeing in each of those cases that we actually have the whole moduli space.
Right, so in some sense, there's already a correlation between maybe this smallest dimensional moduli space, and you could pick out particular gauge group if you look for the complex moduli space with the smallest dimension.
Well, in some of these examples, as I said, you can ask, given the gauge group and given some restriction on what kinds of representations you're allowing for your matter fields, you can write down all the possible models which are anomaly free, and each of those will have some moduli space associated with it. And what we're finding is that we can realize identically every one of those moduli spaces with a string construction. So there I would say we really have got the entire space of theories which are available in the low energy in the six-dimensional supersymmetric context with particular restrictions on gauge group and representations, we can get that entire class of things from string theory. So there's nothing more to vary there. We didn't do this for... So you could do a similar thing to what I just said on E8. And you would... on the E8 cross E8 heterotic theory, and you would get some other set of constructions. What I would say so far is not, I would say, conclusive in the sense that there are lots of six-dimensional supersymmetric models with gauge groups which we have not addressed here. All I would say is that for the ones which have the gauge groups that we've looked at here, we can realize the range of models. It's an interesting question whether that's true for more general classes of gauge groups, and we're thinking about that, but I don't know yet. Absolutely.
They are known as string constructions of those as well.
So, which ones do you think about in particular?
You might say generalized THL constructions, but they can also be realized just on K3 with some tricks, with some automorphisms and so on.
Yeah, so there's a whole class of interesting things that can happen if you combine, going to the E8 cross E8 you can get much bigger groups when you have this enhancement of the gauge group through small instantons at singularities. And I haven't really touched on that part of the story here. I'm kind of really restricting to the rank 16 gauge group with the SO times SUN factors. And obviously, there's a much bigger story of which is just a piece. We were doing this because it was a little piece that we could get a handle on. So I wouldn't try to claim anything very general based on this. I'm just saying we looked at a little piece and we found that we could get pretty much whatever you wanted in that little piece. And we furthermore found a nice mathematical reason why there's a kind of existence and uniqueness theorem for anything you want. But I think it would be very interesting to try to use this kind of technology in a more general way, but we haven't done that yet. We're thinking about it. Stop there. Is there other questions?
Now for the questions, let's invite again.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.